Our founders, and when they wrote the Constitution, I don't think they suspected that we could have a rogue president and a rogue leader in the Senate at the same time.
Silly founders. Should have thought ahead.
Well, I don't know why I came here tonight.
That's why.
I got the feeling that something ain't right.
It ain't.
I'm so scared in case I fall off my chair. And I'm wondering how I'll get down the stairs. Clowns to the left of me, jokers to the right. Here I am, stuck in the middle with you.
Yep.
Yes, I'm stuck in the middle.
From Pacifica Radio in Los Angeles, this is the Bradcast, as heard on KPFK 90.7 FM in L.A. Also in Red Bluff and Redding, California on KFOI, Round Mountains KKRN, and Eureka's KGOE. In Oregon on the Central Coast on KYAQ, Cottage Grove's KSO, and Eugene's KEPW. In Lancaster, Pennsylvania on WLRI, Maui, Hawaii's KAKU. In Columbus, Ohio on WGRN, Palinville, New York's WLPP. In Grand Rapids on WPRR, New Orleans, WHIV. In Gallup, New Mexico on KNIZ. Concord, New Hampshire's WNHN. In Fayetteville, Arkansas on KPSQ. In Seattle on KODX. Janesville, Wisconsin's WADR. And Minneapolis, St. Paul's AM 950 KTNF. And yes, we stream coast to coast and around the globe on some fine internet affiliates, including the Progressive Voices Channel, Netroots Radio, Indie Media Weekly, FYI Nation, NicoleSandler.com, Radio Free Brooklyn, Workforce Rising, Deprogrammed Radio, and Detour Talk, blanketing planet Earth 5 days a week. I am Brad Friedman, your friendly citizen, investigative blogger, journalist, troublemaker, muckraker, and all-around swell fellow, says me from bradblog.com. Thank you very much for joining us in this now post-Donald Trump impeachment world. Wolf Blitzer of CNN, speaking of, posted a fun video on Twitter on Wednesday from October 15, 2008, with then private citizen Donald Trump.
Nancy Pelosi, the Speaker.
Well, you know, when she first got in and was named Speaker, I met her, and I'm very impressed by her. I think she's a very impressive person. I like her a lot. But I was surprised that she didn't do more in terms of Bush and going after Bush. It was almost, it just seemed like she was going to really look to impeach Bush and get him out of office, which personally I think would have been a wonderful thing.
Impeaching him?
Absolutely. For the war. For the war.
Because of the conduct of
the war. Well, he lied. He got us into the war with lies. And, I mean, look at the trouble Bill Clinton got into with something that was totally unimportant, and they tried to impeach him, which was nonsense. And yet Bush got us into this horrible war with lies, by lying, by saying they had weapons of mass destruction, by saying all sorts of things that turned out not to be true.
Well, that clip almost comments upon itself.
There really is a clip and a tweet from Trump on everything contradicts everything he's ever said.
You know, if you lie, that means you need to be impeached. And, of course, having sex with people outside of marriage while you're president, that should be totally unimportant. Anyway, welcome to the broadcast. If you thought the impeachment process was a mess, the post-impeachment process is, frankly, putting it to shame as of last night and into today. That said, I don't actually think impeachment was a mess. In fact, I think the Democrats in the House did a very responsible and respectable job of conservatively pulling the whole story of Donald Trump's criminal Ukraine extortion scandal together in uncovering and presenting the known facts of the case as they have been revealed clearly and responsibly, in pretty much, you know, as orderly and fair and complete a manner as possible, given the White House's obstruction, continuing unprecedented obstruction of that probe, for which Donald Trump has also now been impeached as the second article of impeachment passed along with abuse of power on Wednesday in the U.S. House of Representatives. All of that, of course, with the unprecedented lockstep collusion of the Republican Party, which has entered into this matter to help with the obstruction with their twisted cult leader, wannabe monarch of a president, Donald Trump. I will get to the absolute mess that has now followed Wednesday's historic impeachment vote in the House in a moment. Also coming up in a bit, some election integrity and voting rights news. If I can fit it in, as we scramble to fit in as much as we can before Des and I, hi Desi Doyen,
hello.
Before we bug out for the holidays. But don't worry, you will be in good hands with a mix of new broadcasts with the always delightful and always in a good mood, Nicole Sandler. And what are you laughing about there?
Nicole in a good mood, okay. Always?
And also some choice rebroadcasts along the way while we're gone. But don't worry, we will be right here for the next thrilling broadcast as well to cover Thursday night's Democratic 2020 presidential debate. Oh, yeah. Remember that whole Democratic primary thing? Yes, that is still ongoing, even as we are now just barely a week before the first 2020 primary ballots will be sent out from New Hampshire, followed in quick order a few weeks later by ballots from dozens of early primary and Super Tuesday states. So, yes, this is all ongoing. By the way, Desi Doyen, any idea who you are planning to vote for? Now, you don't have to tell me who. I'm just curious if you have any idea yet.
I have narrowed it down for myself, yes.
You have?
I have.
To how many people?
I'd say to three.
Okay. I'm not certain yet, by the way, but I'm pretty sure it is not going to be the cowardly Tulsi Gabbard.
Yeah, I can go with you on that.
Really?
One. Yeah.
Okay, I'll get to that in a moment. Desi, we'll also today have our last Green News Report of the year a bit later, wherein I think I give a nice Christmas gift to, of all people, Goldman Sachs. Seriously, what happened to me? I've changed. Beyond that, Desi, you will no doubt have plenty of lumps of coal, as usual, for everybody else.
Of course.
Because she is Scroogey that way. So an hour or two after we got off air from our coverage of Wednesday's 11-hour impeachment debate on the House floor, the historic deed was finally done. Democrats voted to adopt two articles of impeachment against the 45th president of the United States, as you may have heard. It is only the third time in our nation's history that that has occurred, and frankly, not a moment too soon. And in a package of articles that, frankly, could have been at least five times as large as they were against this very lucky president. So the first article, Abuse of Power, passed 230 to 197 to 1. That would include two Democrats, Colin Peterson of Minnesota and Jeff Van Drew of New Jersey, voting nay along with the Republicans, and one, Tulsi Gabbard of Hawaii, voting present. The lone independent, that would be the very conservative former Republican Justin Amash of Michigan, he voted yay. He was joined by zero Republicans, however. That was on the first one. The second article, Article 2, Obstruction of Justice, similar numbers with just 229 voting in favor, 198 in this case voting against, and one, once again, Tulsi Gabbard voting present. So it was the same voting makeup except for Jared Golden, Democrat of Minnesota, who decided to vote against obstruction of justice while voting in favor of abuse of power. Jonathan Allen of NBC tweeted that this was unprecedented, that Trump now holds the record for the most votes ever acquired on an article of impeachment at 230 votes. He's number one.
See, he can do that, but I don't think he's going to be touting that one.
Well, he also holds the number two record at 229 votes for the second article. So more votes than anyone ever thought possible. In the meantime, let's see, Corinne Jean-Pierre of MoveOn.org snarked on Twitter, Donald Trump finally won the popular vote. Well, he did in this case. As to Tulsi Gabbard, her vote neither for nor against impeachment, simply voting present. Well, she claimed in a statement after the vote that she was, quote, standing in the center with her present vote. She said, I could not in good conscience vote against impeachment because I believe President Trump is guilty of wrongdoing. So she could not vote against impeachment because she believes he is guilty. All right, that makes sense. She went on to say, I also could not in good conscience vote for impeachment because removal of a sitting president must be the culmination of a partisan, must not be the culmination of a partisan process fueled by tribal animosities that have so gravely divided our country. And that, of course, makes no sense, especially since she said that the president is guilty of wrongdoing.
Yeah.
She went on to declare that Congress must be unequivocal in denouncing the president's misconduct and stand up for the American people and our democracy, although she chose not to do so when she had the chance. So she believes the president is guilty of wrongdoing, but because of all of those corrupt politicians in his own party who decided to vote against his impeachment anyway, she will join them in not voting to impeach the president. That seems to be her ingenious reasoning here. Now, she is a Democrat, supposedly, and she's even running for the Democratic nomination for president of the United States. But she thought it appropriate to allow a corrupt Republican Party to dictate who she would vote for. In other words, if a whole bunch of Republicans had voted for impeachment, I guess she would have voted along with them. But because they didn't, she didn't either. That makes no sense. She calls it a partisan process, but what was partisan about it? I don't really understand what her thinking was. She allowed the Republican Party to decide her own vote. Because, by the way, some Democrats, as I noted, did vote against impeachment. So voting against impeachment was a bipartisan thing. So I know that side couldn't have been partisan. And by the way, as I noted, the very conservative Republican turned independent, Justin Amash, he voted in favor of impeachment. So basically, Tulsi allowed the Republican Party's decision to vote en masse against impeachment to dictate her own vote as well. Now, frankly, I've got much less problem with those two and a half Democrats, I guess, who voted against impeachment, because at least they put their money where their mouth was and their voters know where they stand and can vote accordingly next November. Instead of impeachment, by the way, Gabbard called for consideration of a resolution of censure to censure Trump for his efforts to pressure Ukraine, the Ukrainian government to investigate his political opponents. Well, that'll show them. Very courageous, Tulsi. She argued that it would send a strong message to this president and future presidents that their abuses of power will not go unchecked, while leaving the question of removing Trump from office to the voters to decide. Well, actually, such a resolution would do exactly that. It would leave his abuses of power completely unchecked. So no, I am not certain. The voters would get to decide, by the way, whether there was a resolution of censure or not. So I don't know what she was trying to accomplish there. And no, I am not certain who I will be voting for in the 2020 primaries. But I believe I've got one more person I can add to the list that I will not be voting for. Tulsi Gabbard. I will not. Okay. I know you're a war veteran and all, Tulsi, but please grow a political spine if you actually wish to serve your country in Congress, much less the White House. Gabbard did not qualify, I should note, for Thursday's Democratic debate at Loyola Marymount University here in Los Angeles. That is a pity, because I would love to see her grilled by her fellow Democrats on her action in this matter. We also discussed on yesterday's program with Heather Digby Parton the early whispers that House Democrats may not immediately send the articles of impeachment to the Senate, given the unprecedented statements from Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell and now Lindsey Graham as well, that McConnell has no intention of holding a fair trial for removal of Donald Trump in the Senate, despite the fact that all U.S. senators are required to sign a pledge to pursue impartial justice in impeachment trials. You'll recall last week, McConnell, who serves essentially as the jury foreman in the Senate, since all 100 senators serve as the jury, McConnell boasted to Fox News' Sean Hannity that, yeah, he was planning on rigging the trial in the Senate.
We'll be working through this process, hopefully in a fairly short period of time, in total coordination with the White House counsel's office and the people who are representing the president in the well of the Senate. Everything I do during this, I'm coordinating with White House counsel. There will be no difference between the president's position and our position as to how to handle this. There's no chance the president's going to be removed from office. My hope is that there won't be a single Republican who votes for either of these articles of impeachment.
So again, Mitch McConnell is a juror in this trial. In fact, he's the lead juror because he's the Senate majority leader and gets to decide how this trial would run. Could you imagine if a juror was having meetings with the defendant and saying before a trial, we are going to be in complete lockstep with the defendant? And yet he has the temerity today to be outraged now at what Democrats are now doing or talking about doing. He plans to rig the constitutional impeachment trial for his party, the way he has rigged everything in the U.S. Senate and in the U.S. court system, by the way, including by stealing the Supreme Court for Republicans for a generation. So, yes, the Mitch McConnell crime spree continues. But shortly after the vote on the articles of impeachment on Wednesday, things went quickly south as it became clear that Democrats were actually, yes, as we discussed with Digby yesterday, that they were considering holding back transmitting the articles of impeachment to the U.S. Senate until they received some sort of indication that McConnell wouldn't simply vote to dismiss the articles once they got over there with a bare, 53 vote Republican majority on behalf of the president with whom he admits he is working. As CNN's Manu Raju tweeted after Democrats held their post-impeachment press conference, Pelosi refused to say repeatedly if the House would send over the articles to the Senate. She would not guarantee sending over the articles to the Senate until they are assured a fair trial. Though Raju said she wouldn't describe what a fair trial was, but Ryan Goodman of Just Security, the co-editor-in-chief there, he's also an NYU law professor, said he disagreed. He said that Pelosi did describe what a fair trial is not, citing McConnell's own words about his lack of impartiality in the matter and describing essentially what a fair trial includes, like obtaining key missing witnesses and documents and so forth. So there is a reason, as close listeners to the broadcast may have noticed, that I have been prefacing my coverage in the recent days with words like supposedly, as in my description that the articles of impeachment were, after they were adopted by the House, there would supposedly be a trial for removal in the U.S. Senate. Well, the standoff between the two parties now and the two chambers in Congress is getting worse. It got messier still on Thursday as NBC tried to pull together the many and various and extraordinary threads today. Republican and Democratic leaders in Congress went toe-to-toe on Thursday as a standoff unfolded over the next steps in Donald Trump's impeachment. Speaking to reporters on Thursday, House Speaker Pelosi, who must send the two House-passed articles of impeachment to the Senate before a trial of the president can begin, said she has no intention of taking action until she hears from Senate Majority Leader McConnell about his plans. Pelosi said she will move forward, quote, when we see the process set forth in the Senate. Earlier, McConnell said Pelosi, quote, may be too afraid to send the articles of impeachment, which he described as a shoddy work product. McConnell, speaking on the Senate floor, also lambasted the impeachment as the most rushed, least thorough, and most unfair in modern history.
Just forget about that whole 1998 Clinton impeachment.
He said Pelosi, quote, gave into temptation and that the House impeached Trump, quote, simply because they disagree with a presidential act. That, of course, is complete and utter nonsense. You may love this president. You may want to see, not want to see him removed from office at all costs, even at the cost of undermining our constitutional form of government. But it is simply a lie to say that he was impeached because they disagree with a presidential act. Unless one views, you know, fundamental violations of law like extortion and bribery and campaign finance violations, not to mention high crimes and misdemeanors like abuse of power and obstruction of justice, unless you view that as, you know, friendly disagreements. Speaking with CNN, Congressman Jim Clyburn, a Democrat from South Carolina, who is one of the top-ranking leadership members of leadership in the House, said that delaying the articles was, quote, necessary because McConnell, quote, made very clear he won't be fair and that Democrats may hold on to the articles and not give them to the Senate for, quote, as long as it takes to ensure a fair trial. When the hell did Democrats begin growing this backbone? What the hell? What's going on there?
I don't know. I like it, though.
Well, we'll see how long it lasts.
Yes.
And in the meantime, if they don't send it over, they can do a whole lot of investigating and add even more articles of impeachment while they're waiting. Clyburn said until we get some assurances from the majority leader that he's going to allow a fair and impartial trial to take place, we would be crazy to walk in there knowing he set up a kangaroo court. And Clyburn is absolutely right. Hitting McConnell for the remarks that he made on Thursday, Pelosi hit back hard, appropriately, but she hit hard.
Last night you suggested you needed to see a fair process in the Senate.
But we'd like to see a fair process, but we'll see what they have, and we'll be ready for whatever it is.
Yes, Chad. Is that a requirement? You need to see a fair process before...
We would hope there would be a fair process, just as we hope that they would honor the Constitution. By the way, some of it, I didn't see it, but I heard some of what Mitch McConnell said today, and it reminded me that our founders, when they wrote the Constitution, they suspected that there could be a rogue president. I don't think they suspected that we could have a rogue president and a rogue leader in the Senate at the same time.
Yeah.
Wow. Rogue one and rogue two.
Yeah, I mean, she's right. The founders tried to envision all the ways in which men could be corrupt and be corrupted, but they could not, I guess, imagine the sheer treachery that Mitch McConnell could bring on top of Trump as well.
It is mind-blowing. Good for her for hitting back hard. He is a, well, we have a rogue president and a rogue Senate majority leader. Earlier, McConnell had purposely lied about the Democrats' concerns when he continued his lie on the floor of the Senate to say it looks like the prosecutors are getting cold feet in front of the entire country and second-guessing whether they even want to go to trial. Such actions, he said, concede that their own allegations are unproven. Well, of course, they aren't unproven, Mr. McConnell. But if he wanted more proof, he could very well allow Senate subpoenas for the top witnesses to the crime, who happen to be several of Trump's top officials, who have all refused to answer to lawful congressional subpoenas over in the House. I thought this comment today from McConnell's floor remarks was particularly rich.
The House's conduct risks deeply damaging the institutions of American government.
I mean, no, that wasn't an imitator.
No.
That was actually Mitch McConnell
on the floor of the Senate on Thursday.
Worried about
damaging
the institutions of the U.S. government. Oh, man. All right. Senate Minority Leader Chuck Schumer. I mean, this is all just mind blowing. He spoke on the Senate floor after McConnell. He excoriated the top Republican for proudly saying that he had, quote, no intention to be impartial in the trial. He said of McConnell's earlier evisceration of Democrats' impeachment push, what hypocrisy. Well, it is hypocritical because earlier this week, Schumer proposed calling four Trump administration witnesses, including former National Security Advisor John Bolton, acting White House Chief of Staff Mick Mulvaney, into the Senate trial. And again, you know, if the president did nothing wrong, why would they be concerned about having some of the president's top henchmen appear in the Senate to answer questions?
If he's innocent, yeah, why not? Those people should be able to exculpate him, to free him.
Pointing to those witnesses, Schumer asked, I know, you said exculpate, and I thought of the time that Nancy Pelosi described what that meant to Donald Trump. Anyway, pointing to those witnesses, Schumer asked, is the president's case so weak that none of the president's men can defend him under oath? Maybe that's what the book will be called, None of the President's Men. If the House case is so weak, why is Leader McConnell so afraid of witnesses and documents, said Schumer. Trump also, of course, expressed disdain over the idea that Democrats may not immediately submit the articles. He had it all planned. They had it all worked out. They knew how they were going to undermine this thing. Why is Nancy Pelosi screwing up the plans and holding it up? We were ready to dismiss with this thing. On Thursday, Trump tweeted, now the do-nothing party want to do nothing with the articles and not deliver them to the Senate. But it's Senate call. The Senate shall set the time and place of the trial, he said. If the do-nothing Democrats decide, in their great wisdom, not to show up, they would lose by default. Okay, Mr. President, that's not actually how this works. Not at all how it works, but it is a darling try. And then he continued his attempted bullying from there, calling Pelosi's phony impeachment hoax pathetic and saying she's afraid to present it to the Senate, which can set a date and then put this whole scam into default if they refuse to show up. Nope, not how it works. Pelosi does not dictate what happens in the Senate, a senior White House official insisted to NBC News on Thursday. She can't hold the articles hostage to negotiate the terms in the Senate. Actually, she absolutely can if she wishes to. The Constitution says nothing about that either way. The official added that the House's job is finished. Well, really? Is the House's job finished? Then who are the House managers who will prosecute the case in the Senate? Because I believe that part is in the Constitution. The House's job is not even near finished until those House managers have been named. And as of this hour, anyway, things are changing quickly on this story. They have not been named. So on this all follows, of course, Wednesday, excoriating McConnell on Wednesday for pledging this total coordination with the White House. She said, so far, we have not seen anything that looks fair to us in the Senate. So hopefully it will be fair. And when we see that, then we'll send our managers. Meanwhile, Senator Lindsey Graham, who previously said that he also had no intention of being impartial as a juror in the trial, despite the Constitution's requirement that he pledge to be so, he tweeted that withholding the articles of impeachment would be a, quote, breathtaking violation of the Constitution, an act of political cowardice, and fundamentally unfair to Donald Trump. Well, if anyone knows about violating the Constitution and political cowardice and fundamental unfairness, that would be Lindsey Graham, who, by the way, served as a House impeachment manager himself back in 1998 for the Republicans' partisan impeachment of Bill Clinton over a sexual indiscretion in the White House. He said not allowing the Senate to act on approved articles of impeachment becomes constitutional extortion and creates chaos for the presidency. So now Lindsey Graham is suddenly worried about extortion, not when the president actually uses extortion to coerce a foreign nation into helping him in an upcoming presidential election. And as to creating chaos, I'm sorry, this is just so insane. As to his concern that this will create chaos for the presidency, well, we would hate to see chaos break out around this otherwise totally stable, totally unchaotic presidency. Am I right, Senator? Just for fun, as long as we're looking back at Republicans caught on tape from years ago, The Republicans for Rule of Law, that is a Republican group that now opposes Donald Trump, released this ad on Wednesday.
Once upon a time, Lindsey Graham was in favor of a fair impeachment trial.
In every trial that there has ever been in the Senate regarding impeachment, witnesses were called. When you have a witness telling you about what they were doing and why, it's the difference between getting the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth.
Now that President Trump has been impeached, not so much.
I don't really need to hear a lot of witnesses.
Lindsey Graham, the rules of a fair trial haven't changed. Why have you? Let the witnesses testify.
So I told you it was a mess. And you know, if there's a tweet for everything when it comes to Donald Trump, there's videotape for everything when it comes to Lindsey Graham.
Yeah, but, you know, let's also just be clear that this chaos and this mess is pretty much coming entirely from Republicans, from refusing to fulfill their constitutional duties.
Kurt Bardella, the former spokesperson for Republican Daryl Issa, back when Issa ran the House Oversight Committee, writes about all of this today, calling on Pelosi and Schumer to use what little leverage they have here to hold back the articles, to fight for a fair trial or as close as they can get to one in the Senate before they send the articles over. And he has data to suggest the American people very much would support that effort, at least as of now. He notes that for weeks, the White House and congressional Republicans have been complaining that the Democrats' case is based on hearsay. He quotes House Minority Leader Kevin McCarthy, who told reporters that the foundation of the, quote, the foundation of the case for the Democrats is based on secondhand information. Well, now, Bardella says, is the chance to hold lawmakers like McCarthy to their own rhetorical standard. He says, according to a new ABC News Washington Post poll, more than 7 in 10 Americans think that top Trump officials like acting White House Chief of Staff Mick Mulvaney, Secretary of State Mike Pompeo, former National Security Advisor John Bolton should all be allowed to testify before this Congress. He notes that that number, that 7 in 10 Americans, includes 64% of Republicans and 72% of independents, who think those people should testify in a Senate trial. He says a bipartisan consensus like that is extremely rare, and that Democrats have the opportunity to tie the transmission of the articles of impeachment to the demand that lawmakers and the public hear from witnesses firsthand their firsthand knowledge of the events in question. Legally, he notes, this is somewhat uncharted territory. The Constitution does not give a lot of guidance here on the process, but legal scholars like Harvard Law professor Lawrence Tribe have argued that such an approach is justifiable under the Constitution. Meanwhile, Trump is on record because Donald Trump is an idiot and also, inconveniently for him, a liar. He is on record as saying, quote, I would actually like people to testify. I would love to have Mike Pompeo, Rick Perry, Mick Mulvaney, and many others testify about the phony impeachment hoax, unquote. So, yeah, call the bluff. Bardella writes, the reality is that this is probably the last point of leverage Democrats have left. Once the Senate takes over, it seems incredibly likely that McConnell will make good on his word and exonerate Trump. It won't be a trial. It will be a partisan farce, writes Bardella, the former Republican. He says Democrats owe it to the American people to use every tool at their disposal to try to force Senate Republicans to own their roles in such a charade, even if they are ultimately unsuccessful. Democrats need to make it clear that Donald Trump and Mitch McConnell defied the will of the House and of at least half of the voting population in the bargain. Close to 70% of Americans want to hear from Mulvaney, from Bolton, from Rudy Giuliani under oath. This is one of the rare times when facts, perception, and public opinion all align, he writes. Democrats need to take advantage. And remember, that's from a now former superstar Republican strategist in the U.S. House. I told you it was all going to get much harder and much messier before it even begins to get better in this country. So hang in there. We will get through this together somehow. One way, Well, we've got an election coming up, no matter what happens with this impeachment mess, speaking of messes. But we do have some good news and some sort of good news on that next. From two different states, at least. I'm Brad Friedman. You are listening to the world-famous Bradcast. Don't touch that dial.
Can I get a witness? Can I get a witness?
Well played, Desi Doyen.
Yep.
Smartly done. Welcome back to the Bradcast. Brad Friedman. From bradblog.com. All right, let's jam in some very quick, mostly good news here today. Following the good news a few days ago that Kentucky's brand new Democratic governor signed an executive order allowing some 150,000 former nonviolent felons the right to register and vote in Kentucky. Leaving, by the way, the state of Iowa as the only state in the country to bar all former felons from rejoining civil society by taking part in their own democracy. Following that good news, a little bit more good news on this front today before we get to the holidays. New Jersey will now extend voting rights to residents who are on parole or probation, allowing nearly 73,000 people across the state to cast ballots for the first time next year. At a bill signing on Wednesday, Democratic Governor Phil Murphy said the sea change in criminal justice policy was part of his second chance agenda to prioritize social justice and correcting historical racial discrimination. Murphy said this is the right thing to do. And WHYY cites Ron Pierce, who is on parole after having served 3 decades in prison for murder. And he attended this bill signing, said it was a significant thing for him to regain his voting rights after so many years behind bars. He says, I'm definitely thinking about my father today, who instilled in me from a very young age that to vote has value to the soul. Murphy also signed a law to dramatically expand who can apply for criminal record expungements and sets up an automatic clean slate expungement process for those convicted of less serious offenses who have not committed new crimes in 10 years. Both bills, the Democratic governor said, were aimed at correcting criminal justice policies that have disproportionately affected people of color. He said we would be remiss if we didn't acknowledge that it was 400 years ago this year that the first enslaved Africans arrived on this continent. He said, when I took office 23 months ago, one of the highest priorities I brought with me was to undo the racial disparities in our criminal justice system. Of course, those two new laws inspired pushback from Republicans in the Jersey legislature, who argued that people on parole and probation should serve their full sentences before regaining their voting rights, presumably because keeping people most directly affected by the laws written by those legislators, keeping them from having a say in those laws at all, that is in some way the way Republicans believe democracy should work. But in truth, the pushback, as we all know, is meant just like the disproportionate enforcement of those laws in the first place. It is meant to keep certain people from having access to their franchise and having their voices heard. New Jersey becomes the 17th state, plus Washington, D.C., to allow people on probation and parole to vote. There are only two states, sadly only two states, Maine and Vermont, who allow people to cast ballots even behind bars. And they do so very proudly, as we discussed on this show just a few weeks ago. Law enforcement and correctional facility officials all believing in those states that is the right thing to do for those prisoners to be allowed to vote, and that it is the right thing for both the prisoners and for society at a whole. Some other good-ish news here: after being allowed by a federal judge to purge more than 300,000 voters from the rolls earlier this week, as we previously reported, Georgia election officials restored roughly 22,000 of them on Thursday, citing an error in the way that their voting history had been screened. Huh, shocking. Perhaps that's why voters who had voted as recently as last year were receiving notices from the corrupt Republican Secretary of State's office in Georgia that they had not voted in the past 7 years, so they were being removed from the rolls. That's a point that the plaintiffs had been arguing in this case to prevent this massive purge once again in Georgia. Republican Secretary of State Brad Raffensperger's office, giving all Brads a bad name, said the issue stemmed the mistake that ended up with the 22,000 people on this list who should not be on this list stemmed from the way the process of maintaining the voter list was carried out back in 2015 before he was in office, and thus tossing former Republican Secretary of State Brian Kemp, who muscled his way into becoming governor last November, tossing Kemp under a well-deserved bus, I guess. Raffensperger's office on Monday purged more than 300,000 voters that were deemed inactive. A federal judge is set to hear arguments on Thursday about whether some of those should actually be reinstated after the voting rights advocacy group founded by Democrat Stacey Abrams, called Fair Fight Action, filed an emergency motion earlier this week asking the court to stop part of the purge, including to some 120,000 voters who they say should likely not be on this purge list at all. The statement from the Secretary of State's office on Thursday says that instead of being purged, the 22,000 people affected will now be moved back onto the inactive status list, giving them more time before they are then removed from the rolls. In a statement decrying that admission just 2 hours before the court hearing today, Fair Fight Action CEO Lauren Groh-Wargo said in a statement that Raffensperger's, quote, 11th hour admission that he made massive errors in this week's voter purge should send chills down the spine of every Georgian who cares about voting rights. The fact that Raffensperger agrees with Fair Fight Action that he failed to follow the law and illegally took away 22,000 Georgians' right to vote is refreshing, she said, but it is not enough. Every voter purged this week under the state's use it or lose it law must be reinstated immediately. Well, Raffensperger's office has defended the list maintenance, saying that it makes the administration of elections smoother and helps guard against voter fraud. But of course he does. It does also help against guard against, you know, voting by certain people, which is, as always, at the heart of all of this. Thankfully, for the moment, the watchdogs in Georgia are fighting hard for we the people against corrupt partisan election officials like Raffensperger, who would rather stop pretend voter fraud, even if it means tens of thousands of perfectly legal voters can't cast a vote. The judge in the case said that he could order many others to be restored after Thursday's hearing.
I sure hope he does, because obviously they've got some real big problems with how they've compiled this list in Georgia.
We will see. We will see what happens. All right. Quickly, if I can, four other things, if I can get them in before the Green News Report coming up in a moment, all of which I would love to cover in more detail, but I simply can't for lack of time. Okay. One, last Friday, I spoke with UC Berkeley Professor Philip Stark, the inventor of the so-called risk-limiting audit, or RLA, protocol that many election integrity groups call for as a post-election spot check of sorts to determine whether optical scan computers, computer tabulators correctly recorded results of votes cast by voters. I'm not a fan of post-election audits, as I discussed with the professor. But in any event, Stark, when I had him on, had just loudly declared his resignation from the board of directors of the longtime, previously well-respected e-voting watchdog group VerifiedVoting.org. He loudly resigned because of the group's position in support of 100% unverifiable touchscreen ballot marking devices at the polling place. and their support of so-called RLAs, risk-limiting audits, in Georgia and in Pennsylvania after last month's disastrous off-year elections in those states, where they both deployed for the very first time these touchscreen ballot marking devices, or BMDs, for all voters at the polls, not just for disabled voters who might need an assistive device, but for all voters. In Philadelphia, across the entire state of Georgia. And so he said, no, he can't support verified voting anymore. Well, good for him. No sooner did we get off the air discussing his resignation from verified voting due to that dangerous position on BMDs and RLAs. But another member of the board, Georgia Tech professor Rich DeMillo, his resignation was also made public. His letter blasted verified voting's, quote, unpredictable and contradictory positions on BMDs and RLAs, describing verified voting as giving their seal, quote, seal of approval for the security theatrics in the audits conducted in Georgia and Pennsylvania after last month's disastrous elections, where the BMD machines that I have been warning about for months, years, actually, where they failed to record thousands of votes last month. That resignation letter from Rich, who has been a guest on this show, is posted and in a story about both of those resignations now at fastcompany.com under the headline, Two Experts Quit Election Accountability Group Over Claims It Has Been Endorsing Untrustworthy Machines. And I should note, by way of full disclosure, I have worked with a lot of the folks at verifiedvoting.org over the years in one way or another. They've been guests on the show. I respect their opinions. There's a lot of really good folks there. And two of those good folks have just left, which is sad. I hope Verified Voting rethinks their position. And there is evidence they have begun to do so. In the wake of all of this, Verified Voting has now posted a new, quote, statement on ballot marking devices and risk limiting audits at their website, verifiedvoting.org, hoping to respond to the heavy critique, which I am told has lost them, certainly much of their reputation, and also I'm told no small amount of funding. While the statement is a step in the right direction, if you read it over there, it still fails to appreciate, in my opinion, the full dangers of running elections that are completely unverifiable on BMDs, which I have always found to be ironic given the name of the group is Verified Voting. Which part of verified is unclear to them? So anyway, I hope to share their statement in more detail at a later time. I'm just short on it right now. I also want to note that our friend Jenny Cohen, another guest on this show and a popular election integrity advocate on the Twitters, has written one hell of an article, an encyclopedic expose on the dangers and failings of BMDs. It is a must read. As far as I'm concerned, it's on the failings of BMDs and on the election integrity groups like Verified Voting who have failed to oppose them, and on the private vendors and election officials and the revolving doors and payoffs that have brought us to this perilous moment. You can and should read that story at New York Review of Books. That's nybooks.com.
And you'll link to it as well at the Brad blog.
I will. The headline there is How New Voting Machines Could Hack Our Democracy. It is fantastic. And while I'm glad it's published at the New York Review of Books, frankly, it should have been published by the New York Times, let's say, 10 years or so ago. And then one more piece that I don't have time for, but I want to make sure you know about before the holidays. NBC News has actually published something today worth a read. Again, it would have been worth even more of a read about 10 or 15 years ago. But the headline there in the article by Ben Popkin, Cynthia McFadden, and Kevin Monahan, that's their investigative news group, is Chinese Parts, Hidden Ownership, Growing Scrutiny, Inside America's Biggest Maker of Voting Machines. Subheadline, Scrutiny of the U.S. Election System, spurred by Russian interference in the 2016 election, has put election systems and software, or ES&S, in the political spotlight. And the article goes on to talk about how a whole bunch of those parts in those machines that are being forced on voters once again in 2020 come from, guess where? China. And they are not scrutinized to make sure they do not include malware and all other kinds of dangers. Check that out at NBCNews.com. Chinese parts, hidden ownership, growing scrutiny for ES&S. Quick break, and we are back with the Green News Report right after this. I'm Brad Friedman. Don't go away. And you thought I wasn't going to be able to get it in.
See, true.
We'll always fit it in. Our latest Green News Report.
As fires continue to burn from coast to coast, now the country resembles a furnace.
Australia swelters through hottest day ever recorded down under. November 2019 was the second hottest November ever recorded. Ocean acidification is accelerating off the U.S. West Coast. Plus,
U.S. banking giant Goldman Sachs says it won't finance oil drilling in the Arctic moving forward.
Goldman Sachs just says no to drilling in the Arctic.
Yay, Goldman Sachs. Did I just say that?
Yeah.
All of those surprises and more straight ahead from bradblog.com. I'm Brad Friedman.
And I'm Desi Doyen.
Stand by for 6 minutes of independent green news, politics, analysis, and snarky comment.
200-foot flames this weekend raced across the Australian outback. In Sydney, the smoke is so bad, it's like smoking 32 cigarettes a day. Greenland is losing ice 7 times faster than it was in the 90s. The warnings are there. But who is listening?
No one. Merry Christmas and a Happy New Year. This is your Green News Report. I'm gonna soak up the sun. Okay, Desi Doyen, it is very, very bad down in Australia.
Oh my, yes, it is. Australia has sweltered through its hottest day ever recorded from a blistering continent-wide heat wave, hitting a national average temperature of 105 degrees. That's according to the country's Bureau of Meteorology, shattering the previous record set in 2013 by a full degree and intensifying at least 100 active bushfires across New South Wales amid the worst drought in decades.
I'm sorry, did you say a national average of 105 degrees?
Yes, wow. Across the entire continent. Officials warn the all-time high is likely to be broken again, and they've declared a state of emergency over the heat, fires, and hazardous air pollution.
Yeah, I guess they have.
Shane Fitzsimmons, Rural Fire Service Chief, warned that firefighting resources are being stretched thin.
We're up around 8,500 fires so far this season, so that's the sort of challenge that that firefighters and emergency services personnel are facing every day, and we've seen it day in, day out, week in, week out, month in, month out now, since winter.
And we should note here that Australia is home to some of the fiercest climate change denialists in the world. I wonder if that's about to change.
Meanwhile, the heat goes on. NOAA announced this week that November 2019 was the second hottest November recorded globally since record-keeping began in the 1880s. The 5 warmest Novembers on record all have been measured since 2013. 2019 is almost certain to be the second warmest year on record, capping off the warmest decade ever recorded. 8 of the 10 warmest years have all occurred this decade. The other 2 were just a few years earlier.
Well, you know, I don't want to give short shrift to the climate denialists here in our country either.
NOAA also announced that waters in the Pacific Ocean off the West Coast are acidifying at twice the rate of the rest of the global oceans. Now, the ocean absorbs some of humanity's carbon dioxide emissions, which is changing the chemistry of the ocean, making it more acidic. That makes it harder for shellfish to form their shells, and that has potentially catastrophic effects on commercial shell fisheries. A new study finds that costs of the shale gas fracking boom in Pennsylvania, Ohio, and West Virginia far outweigh the benefits. Researchers calculated that since 2004, shale development generated a regional economic boost of $21 billion, but cost $23 billion in costs related to 1,200 to 4,600 premature deaths that were caused by increased air pollution from the industry. That's $21 billion in economic activity from fracking, causing $23 billion in health costs and thousands of premature deaths.
Yeah, but you got to look at who is being affected and who's making all that money.
But some good news. 12 northeastern states have joined forces to reduce air pollution, unveiling a draft plan for a cap-and-trade program to cut tailpipe emissions from cars, trucks, and other forms of transportation. As the nation's electric grid gets greener, transportation has become the largest source of greenhouse gas emissions in the United States. And finally, banking giant Goldman Sachs announced this week that it will not finance new oil and gas drilling projects or exploration in the Arctic, and instead will invest $750 billion in sustainable development and climate transition over the next 10 years. It is the first U.S. bank to do so.
So they won't help Donald Trump drill in Anwar?
They will not.
Good for Goldman Sachs. There, I said it again. For much more on all of these stories and the ones we couldn't get to today, please check out our website at greennews.bradblog.com. Our thanks to those of you who stopped by bradblog.com/donate to help Desi and I do what we try to do year-round. And please find, follow, and share all that we do on the Facebooks and the Twitters at Green News Report. We'll be off for a couple of weeks over the holidays, but from Desi and I to you and yours, please have a safe, happy, and healthy holiday. I'm Brad Friedman.
And I'm Desi Doyen.
And this has been your Green News Report.
Icicles on eavesdrops and tinsel on the tree, but it's a green Christmas for me.
And just to be clear there.
Yes.
Green News Report will be off for the next couple of weeks. We're not off yet. We've got another show on the debate coming up, the next presidential debate. And, of course, Nicole Sandler will be here with all kinds of fun over the holidays for you. So we ain't going anywhere as much as you would like us to. All right. My thanks to our producer, Desi Doyen, to all of you for spending a portion of your day or night with us. If you missed any portion of today's show or any other, download it anytime for free at bradblog.com. We want to keep all of those archives open to as many people as possible for as long as possible. And that is all made possible by those of you who stop by bradblog.com/donate. To help us do it. Bradblog.com/donate. Drop me email. I am bradcast@bradblog.com. And on the Facebooks and the Twitters, I am the Brad Blog. That is it. Thank you all. Until we meet again, I'm Brad Friedman. Good luck, world.
Red nose on the reindeer, tinsel on the tree, but it's a green Christmas for me.